ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
On a wide tree-lined street in Queensland, Australia, there is a house, a 19th century ornate mansion.
The mansion itself is two stories. It's brick. It's got a couple of chimneys and it has a lovely sweeping veranda around three sides of the mansion. And it's all decorated by that lovely wrought ironwork. If you can imagine, like, beautiful leafy trees, very well maintained flower beds, imagine high teas on the lawn and those sorts of things.
And behind this mansion, tucked away in its lush gardens, sits a shed.
There was a garage with a dirt floor and very hot and dusty.
But this grand old estate was more than just a house. It was also home to one of Australia's greatest war secrets, a team of young women from all walks of life working tirelessly inside that hot, dirt-floored garage.
And they were codebreakers whose history has been forgotten until recently, and they helped change the course of World War II.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of a group of women who called themselves the Garage Girls, and how their classified work played a key role in World War II, only to have their stories forgotten for decades, and no one saw it coming. A few years ago, author Ali Sinclair was doing some research for a book she was writing. She stumbled across something in the archives that made her spidey senses tingle.
I was really interested in investigating women in war in World War II. So I sort of went down the research rabbit hole and I found a very, very tiny article about Central Bureau. And I'm like, oh, I've never heard about Central Bureau. What's all this about?
And yes, Central Bureau is just as mysterious as it sounds.
And the name Central Bureau was actually formulated to make it sound very nondescript. You know, you sort of hear Central Bureau, it doesn't sound that enticing. So you just think, oh, it's just another, you know, military department. But what Central Bureau did was actually quite central to a lot of the major turning points in World War II in the Pacific.
So is it an intelligence centre? Like, what is actually, I assume this is declassified and you can tell me, but what actually was it in reality?
Yeah, so what Central Bureau did is they worked in signals intelligence and they worked on the Army and the Air Force codes, decrypting those for the Japanese Army and Air Force intelligence. And there was a multinational team. There were Australians, people from the UK, from the US, Canada, New Zealand, the Netherlands, and it was really, really important part of Australian history that I think, you know, not that many people have known about until quite recently, because when Central Bureau closed after the war, pretty much all of their records were burned.
Yeah, I mean, when they start setting evidence alight, you're about as top secret as you can get. So, Central Bureau originally was set up in Melbourne, and then they moved it to Brisbane in this huge house, the one that we described earlier. In fact, it was so grand that it was literally called the mansion by people who worked there.
And inside, it was a real rabbit warren of offices just sort of taken over by the men who worked in the mansion.
And so, you've got the United Nations of intelligence officials in here. Are they all working on their own thing or is there a bit of overlap? How does it actually work?
Yeah, so at Central Bureau, they actually cover quite a lot of things. They were focusing on Japanese Army and Air Force intelligence, but the Australians, their main role was traffic analysis. So they were studying messages that flowed between the Japanese units, so they'd track who was going where, and that could really be helpful for the Allies to understand the movements and either be there or avoid it. But there was also the Americans. Most of the Americans were sort of working on cryptanalysis, so they were breaking the Japanese codes and ciphers. And then I guess the rest of the United Nations sort of worked in those areas, as well as admin and those sorts of things.
It's wild to me that there's this gorgeous mansion in Brisbane that had a bunch of intelligence operatives from around the world working on cracking codes, just sitting there in the leafy suburbs of Brisbane, and it's in this gorgeous, gorgeous building.
Yeah, well, one of the things was that they really wanted to fly under the radar because of what they were doing. So it wasn't really that uncommon for houses to be taken over for military operations. So the neighbours did know that there were definitely military in that particular house. They just had no idea what they did. But I know if I was a neighbour, I'd love to be knowing what was going on. I wouldn't be able to help myself.
So at the back of the mansion, which has all the men in suits working inside of it, there's this garage. It's got a dirt floor, tin roof. And you have to remember, this is in Queensland, so the summer heat, it is stifling. You can just imagine how suffocating and sweaty it would have been to work long hours in there. But the people who worked in this shed, they had real grit.
A group of amazing ladies who actually nicknamed themselves the Garage Girls, and they were very pivotal to Central Bureau and a lot of the work and success of the Allies in the Pacific War.
So how many girls are we talking about here, and what's the age range?
36, and they worked in three groups of 12 over 24 hours. And the average age, they were like teenagers, 18 to 20, 21 years old. They were really young. Most of them came from the country, so they'd never been living in a city like Brisbane. And you can imagine with 100,000 US troops, they did have good time.
Noted.
But these young women, look, some of them left school at 14, at 16. They worked in bakeries, they worked for the post office, they worked in haberdashery stores. But they ended up being recruited because they were young, they were single, which meant that there was no chance that they, you know, would be tempted to tell anyone what they were doing, like, you know, their partner or husband. And they had never worked in technology before. So it was a massive leap for these ladies.
So how were they recruited to be code breakers in the first place?
So the Garage Girls joined the army, like a lot of other women. They were sent off to military training at Ingleburn Army Camp. Then they went off to do a signals course at Bonegilla. It's sort of on the Victorian and New South Wales border, where they did a lot of Morse code and wireless messaging. Obviously, there were people looking at these recruits and seeing how they work with patterns and problem solving and critical thinking, all those sorts of things. Then they sort of get a little tap on the shoulder and get sent off to Melbourne for more intensive training in signals intelligence. They were just put on a train in Melbourne and said, "You're going to Brisbane?" And they turned up in Brisbane. They had no idea where they were going, what they were doing. And they get off the train in Brisbane. They're shipped directly to Nyrambla, to the Central Bureau headquarters. And it's not then, until then, that they're actually told that they'll be part of the cipher unit and this is what you'll be doing.
Hold on. They just get chucked on a train, sent to Brisbane, and then when they arrive, they're like, "You guys are now intelligence operatives." Is that pretty much? That is staggering.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So we've done a lot of build-up. Ali, what was it that the Garage Girls at the back of the mansion were actually doing during the war?
So their role was in the cipher unit of Central Bureau. And so they encrypted and decrypted messages from the Japanese army that had been intercepted through different outposts in Townsville, in Darwin, overseas, in Brisbane as well. They also sent and received encrypted communications between the Allied forces. So they'd be dealing a lot with the army and the Air Force who are out in the Pacific. And they also dealt a lot with sending and receiving messages from Bletchley Park in the UK, as well as Arlington Hall in the USA.
Which is really kind of worth pointing out here because for people that, you know, follow kind of World War II history, Bletchley Park is a very famous place in the UK where famous codes were broken. It's got movies about it. It's got books about it. But in some ways, what you've uncovered here at the mansion is kind of our end of that story, right?
Yeah, I often refer to it as Australia's Bletchley Park. They actually had a clock inside the garage that was set on Greenwich Mean Time as well.
So let's talk about how they actually did this decoding, because this stuff is fascinating, right? How did it actually work?
Yeah, so they worked on Typex machines. If you look at them, they're quite clunky. So they've got a keypad, and on both sides they've got very big black cylinders, and inside those cylinders is paper tape, like very thin paper tape. And depending on whether they were decoding or encoding messages, one of those roles would be working. So the machines themselves had five rotating wheels, and they scrambled or unscrambled the messages, and that was probably the most important thing that they did.
When it comes to decoding, there's this idea called padding, where the information is like it's embedded in the messages.
So the padding was designed to make the message longer. There was all kind of nonsensical things that you could put in there. It might be something like the white dog eats carrots, MacArthur leaves Brisbane at 0900. I love yellow flowers. So when you scramble all that together, I mean, you've got quite a few letters then to have to decipher. So if the enemy tried to crack the code at all, it'd be very, very complicated, more so than, you know, MacArthur leaves Brisbane at 0900.
Despite that padding, the garage girls still managed to decipher messages sent by the Japanese. And it had huge impact throughout the war. There's one big event, though, that stands out, right? And it's one big event that the involvement of the garage girls has largely been ignored by the history books. And that is the death of Admiral Yamamoto of the Imperial Japanese Navy in April 1943.
Considered one of the great strategists in the Japanese Navy, and enemy number one by the United States.
He was the architect of the Pearl Harbor attacks, so the Allies really wanted to stop him from causing more destruction.
It was December 1941 when the Imperial Japanese Navy launched a surprise air attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii.
The warlord struck first and hard.
A number of US battleships were damaged or sunk. Grounded aircraft and other ships were destroyed, and 2,400 Americans were killed, with hundreds more wounded.
And there was a very big plan to try and find him, and it was called Operation Vengeance.
Because they wanted to avenge the attack on Pearl Harbor.
And that happened in April 1943. So some Japanese radio signals were intercepted by the Australians, and they discovered that he was going to be visiting the Solomon Islands and New Guinea. And through the cracking of the codes, they were actually able to pinpoint the time, the exact place, everything they needed to know.
Everything they needed to know to take down Yamamoto's plane.
Yes, the Supreme Japanese Naval Commander, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, mastermind of the dastardly sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, gunned from the skies of the South Pacific by these Army Air Corps flyers, wrote a chapter that history may regard as the turning point of this war.
If you read about Operation Vengeance and the downing of Yamamoto's plane, you will not see any reference to the garage girls, which is, I mean, it's kind of the point. And there were so many people involved in the intelligence that pieced together his exact location on that day. The women in Brisbane, they were one piece of a larger puzzle.
Helen Kenny, one of the garage girls, was actually involved in the intercept that led to the shooting down of Admiral Yamamoto's plane. One of the things that she has said in the past is that she was quite frustrated because what the garage girls would do is they would figure out these messages and then it'd be passed on to the gentleman in the mansion, and then that would be it because it's top secret. Everyone sort of worked in silos. You only knew what happened outside of your particular unit if it was necessary. So a lot of the time, the garage girls would have these decryptions and they would send them off and never know what happened. But obviously, with the news of Yamamoto's death, Alan was able to piece it all together. And so the Australians actually didn't get as much credit as I feel that they deserve.
Around a year after Yamamoto's death, during the Battle of Seio in New Guinea, a Japanese plane went down. And on that plane was some very special cargo.
So on that particular plane was a steel trunk that contained code books from the Japanese 20th Army Division. So these code books were really important because it actually was the key to all of the codes that they used to communicate to each other.
So the Japanese plane goes down, pilots survive, and they know if these code books get into enemy hands, the Japanese are in trouble. But they can't burn them because the smoke would give away their location to the Allies in the area. So instead, they decided to hide them.
They buried the trunk into a riverbed, but then an Australian sapper actually discovered this steel trunk. And when he opened it, discovered that there were the Japanese code books. So then the code books then got sent to Central Bureau and they were carefully prized apart page by page. You can imagine how painful it would have been not to, you know, rip anything. And then Helen Kenny, again, one of our garage girls, was actually putting these papers up onto the clothesline to dry and hopefully preserve so that these codes could then actually be used to decipher the Japanese signals very quickly, which they did. And it really sped up the Allies' victory in the war.
I just have this image of them hanging out pages of Japanese codes on a Hills hoist.
It's so domesticated.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing. But it really changed the course of history.
The news flashed around the world.
This is London. The Prime Minister, the Right Honourable C.R. Apte.
Japan has today surrendered.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Prime Minister of the Commonwealth of Australia, Mr. J.B. Chifley.
Fellow citizens, the war is over.
Australia joined her allies in an outburst of rejoicing, the like of which her cities had never seen before. The pent-up emotion of 6 years poured out as a flood. Freedom was really theirs.
So when the war ended, what happened to these incredible women?
Yeah, a lot of the women went back to their regular lives, some married, some moved on to have amazing careers. Helen Kenny became the first cadet ever at the Australian Women's Weekly and she was quite an awarded journalist. And, yeah, a lot of the women just sort of went on to live regular lives.
Carrying these incredible secrets with them.
Absolutely.
So Ali mentioned this earlier, but I think it's important to emphasise. Because the physical records of the Central Bureau were destroyed, it means the oral histories of the work done in the mansion and the garage, they are so important, right? Not only for our understanding of the time and the work that got done, but also as a record of the garage girls themselves, how they felt about their lives. And Ali actually tracked down one of the surviving garage girls, Coral Hines, who was in her 90s at this point, to hear her story.
I don't know why we were chosen, but we all had the same trust. This was the thing, and like with Helen, she'd been in this sort of work and knew what it was, but we were all trusted.
Coral is an amazing, amazing lady. Originally from Victoria, and Coral was one of the original garage girls. I was really, really lucky in that I met Coral quite a few years ago when I was researching my book. And from there, we actually struck up an amazing friendship and she introduced me to a couple of our other friends, other garage girls. And yeah, through them, I was able to actually hear their stories and to understand not just from a political, working kind of point of view, but also from a social situation of what it was like for young women going to the city for the first time and undertaking this work that they had to keep secret for over 30 years because they signed the Official Secrets Act. And they weren't allowed to tell a soul. They couldn't tell anybody, not their mother, their father, their cousins, no one.
We were in the garage. It was less conspicuous. You know, nobody would expect us to be around the back there.
Wow.
And the machines and things were just put in this garage, and it was just a decoy.
There's an interesting thing that happens to these women, which is, in effect, they spend their years serving in silence, and then that silence continues for years afterwards. How do you think that affected them?
For quite a few, it really drove a wedge in their lives between their loved ones and themselves, because they never really felt that they could be their own self 100% of the time, because they still couldn't talk about what they did. A lot of the women said they just worked in admin. It was an easier explanation, but it was quite difficult for some of the women. They found that it really affected their relationships in a way. And then others were just able to, I guess, compartmentalize it and just put it in that little filing cabinet in your brain and say, okay, well, that happened, and I'll just move on with the rest of my life.
Hmm. How long did it take for these women to be publicly recognised for what they did?
Oh, my goodness, such a long time. So in 2009, the women received the Bletchley Park Commemorative Medal from the UK, but it actually took until 2019 for the Australian government to actually award them a medal for their service.
Wait, so obviously we're British Dominion during World War II, so that in some ways it makes sense, but it's like the British government gave them a medal before the Australian government did.
They sure did.
That's wild.
It is. It is. Yeah, it's I was flabbergasted. I couldn't believe it when I first heard that.
Because when we got recognition from the British government, we were classed as one of Britain's outstations. And it sort of really came home that, yes, we were all part of the one.
So in 2023, there are three remaining women, Coral Hines, Joyce Grace and Elsa Hale, were actually awarded the Australian Intelligence Medal. So on January 26th, Coral found out that she was being awarded this medal, but unfortunately in February she passed away. But her son Anthony was able to travel to Canberra in April to the Government House and actually received the award on her behalf. And I can tell you right now, there was not a dry eye in that room.
I mean, it should have happened decades before.
It absolutely should have.
How do you see the legacy of the Garage Girls, particularly given the fact that it was so secret for so long?
So the legacy of the Garage Girls is such an important part of history, especially from a female perspective. It was such an amazing example of how women, given an opportunity, could really step up and make a difference. And they definitely have paved a way for women in future decades. I know that the former Director General of the Australian Signals Directorate, Rachel Noble, and the current Director General of the Australian Signals Directorate, Abigail Bradshaw, actually credit their success in signals intelligence to women like the Garage Girls, who have shown that they can do amazing things when given an opportunity.
And besides being trailblazing female code breakers, first and foremost, they were women, young women, who were thrown into this crazy, intense, top secret job during a world war. And the friendships they forged were incredibly strong.
Because these women, you know, they lived in the same barracks. They worked in the same tiny little garage. They couldn't talk to anyone else about their work. So these friendships were very, very intense. And that was one thing I think a lot of them found was really difficult after the war, is because they all sort of spread out, you know, different parts of Australia or went overseas. The friendships were really, really, really important for these women.
We made friends, good friends. We were just a group that we just seemed to click and get on. As the years have gone on, I've kept in touch with them, and when things happen, sometimes it's Elsa or Joy is the first ones I ring. They're there. Yeah. Just your good friends.
The late Coral Hines, one of the garage girls who worked in Central Bureau in World War II. Very big thank you to Ali Sinclair for being our guest. Her book, The Codebreakers, tells the story of the garage girls, and apparently it's being turned into a documentary called Red Lipstick Intelligence. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson. The sound engineer was Hamish Camilleri. No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia, ABC Radio National. As ever, if you've got a story you'd like us to investigate, you know the email, noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. I'm Mark Fennell, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode, and I'll see you then. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.